of the longest reigning monarch in the UK that glued millions of people to their television sets and many more onto the streets to pay tribute to the Queen. And we saw a lot of people also get emotional and shed a tear, but they had their own reasons. At the same time, there were millions of others who didn't do any of that for all kinds of other reasons. One, you alluded to, the excess of it all, the fact that the taxpayer has to pick up the tab, foot the bill, so to speak, for the expense that is involved, that the British government spare money has to grant the monarchy that's worth tens of billions of dollars themselves, tens of millions of dollars in taxpayer money every year to cover their expenses, such as their travels and their security, as well as the renovations of their palaces. That really has not gone down well with the public here, and the public at a time when they are having to decide between heating their homes and eating in the coming months with the soaring cost of energy that is central to driving up the cost of living, creating a crisis that has affected millions of households in across the UK, from where I am in England all the way to Northern Ireland, to Scotland, to Wales. That has not gone down well with the public, who are questioning the relevance of the monarchy as an anachronistic, outdated institution that is still around in the United Kingdom. People who are saying that they don't understand the relevance of it in the 21st century, that it's, now is the time. These are Republican voices and other people who are saying that perhaps it is the time to rid the UK of the monarchy once and for all. Whether or not that will happen, or how long it'll take for that to happen, is only something that time will show moving forward. Kaveh.
Thank you very much for that, Syed Pourreza. We appreciate it. Of course, one of their Syed Pourreza from London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Let me now introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Clive Menzies, researcher and political economy analyst, joins us from London. Also joining us is Sayed Mohammad Inayatullah and Drabe, who's an author and political analyst, also joining us from London. Well, I'd like to welcome you both. Clive Menzies, let me first start with you. We're looking at 11 consecutive days at this point, and so you're in London, so you could confirm this, and I'm wondering what you think about the passing away of the Queen. When we take a look at things like handwritten note from King Charles to his late mother, that's given extensive coverage, that was laid on top of her coffin. The Queen's corgis and pony await her arrival at Windsor Castle, extensive coverage. A spider appears on top of a note card, or the Queen's coffin lowered into a vault ahead of burial. Do you think that this type of coverage to this extent is actually something that's necessary?
I also question how much of it is theatre, because there are reasons to suppose that the Queen may have died a long time ago, and that this was the chosen moment to effect the transition from one monarch to the other. But it presupposes that the monarch actually plays a symbolic role rather than a more powerful role. And I think it is certainly from the analysis that I've been involved with others over the years, wealth and power are synonymous. And the fact that from a cosmetic point of view, the Queen supposedly only has a symbolic role, I think the evidence suggests that the monarchy and its family have been much more involved in what has been going on for centuries, not just the current family, but also if you go, the role that they played in the 20th century has been quite pivotal in the way the world has developed. And that's what the evidence shows. In terms of the theatre that we've been subjected to over the last 10 years, I think there are those who understand what is going on, and I would say that numerically they're in the minority. There are those who resent what's going on because of the artificially created energy shortages from the so-called climate crisis, of which the current appointee to the monarchy has been instrumental in perpetuating in various guises. And then there are a majority who I would suggest are subjected to Stockholm syndrome. They're basically enthralled to their abusers because the monarchy is as much a part of the panoply of power under which we live as the government. And in fact, arguably, the government is not in control, neither is the monarchy, but both are actually answerable to a higher power that is global.
Well, that's an interesting thing you just said there. We need to open that up a little bit with you, but Andrabi, our guests are also within that statement is saying that the role of the Queen or the monarchy in general is not ceremonial. Do you agree?
Bismillah ar-Rahman.
Headlines: Iran's president says an agreement on reviving the 2015 deal is not possible without giving necessary guarantees to Tehran. A new investigation uncovers further evidence that the death of Palestinian journalist Shirin Abu Akleh at the hands of Israeli forces was deliberate. And former Brazilian President Lula da Silva is expanding his lead over the incumbent Jair Bolsonaro ahead of next month's elections. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisum Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi says it will not be possible to reach an agreement on reviving the 2015 deal without closing Tehran's case at the IAEA. Ebrahim Raisi made the remarks in a meeting with the French President Emmanuel Macron on the sidelines of the 77th UN General Assembly in New York. Raisi said the IAEA has officially acknowledged 15 times that Iran's activities are fully consistent with its commitments. He also told Macron that the European signatories need to prove that their policies are independent from the U.S. The Iranian president also discussed the nuclear issue in a separate meeting with the Swiss president. He said that it is reasonable for Tehran to demand guarantees for a durable deal, given the history of Washington's behavior and how it left the deal back in 2018. Washington unilaterally withdrew from the multilateral agreement on Iran's nuclear program and reimposed illegal sanctions on Tehran.
The 77th United Nations General Assembly has opened, with the UN Secretary General warning of a winter of discontent as many Western nations are economically reeling from the backfiring of their sanctions on Russia. Iranian President Sayed Ebrahim Raisi will give his first address to the UN on September 21st, with a focus on creating a more just world through economic multilateralism. Raisi met with French President Emmanuel Macron and top leaders of the European Union, but amid what Iranian delegates described as a very tense atmosphere. France and the other Western signatories have failed for years to adhere to the 2015 Landmark Agreement, also known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA. Raisi told Macron that Europe needs to show that its foreign policies are guided by the sovereign interests of their citizens and actually separate from the demands of Washington. This week, Raisi will hold bilateral meetings with the heads of Iraq, Pakistan, Japan, and more than a half dozen other nations, as well as with representatives of a large Iranian-American community, a group estimated to be well over 2 million people. Raisi stressed that Iran is willing to reach a, quote, fair and stable agreement to revive the 2015 deal, but that Iran needs to receive reassuring guarantees that the U.S. will not withdraw from the accord as it did in May 2018. Ramin Mazahiri, New York City.
We were earlier joined by journalist and political commentator Said Mohsen Abbas. He discussed the recent comments by Iran's president. Let's take a listen.
It seems that about a year ago in particular, the IAEA, under the Director General Rafael Mariano Grossi, has leaned increasingly towards an Israeli stance. I mean, Grossi actually visited Israel as well. Let's not forget that this is the same Mr. Grossi who heads the IAEA that is meant to bring Israel to the table in terms of its nuclear violations, essentially. 400 nuclear weapons, pretty good violation by any measure, given that the Israelis don't even want to come onto the table of any kind of on nuclear proliferation agreements. They don't want to be inspected by the IAEA. Yet here was Mr. Grossi going off to Israel to take his orders. Many would allege that he actually is in cahoots with the Israeli agenda on the JCPOA. And of course, we know that Israel does not want the JCPOA to go ahead. And I think to consider the IAEA now as some sort of independent outfit, if it was ever going to be an independent outfit, well, certainly it's lost all credibility in the eyes of anybody who looks on neutrally. He's also made some really strange statements.
New evidence shows that Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akla was intentionally targeted and killed by Israeli soldiers, despite the regime's claim that it was an accident. A London-based research group and a Palestinian rights group have conducted a fresh investigation into the controversial case. They say the sniper's precise angle of the fire shows that an Israeli soldier was clearly able to tell that there were journalists around. The sniper first shot twice to kill Abu Akla and then proceeded to open fire on those who tried to rescue her. The Palestinian journalist was killed 4 months ago while covering an Israeli raid on the Jenin refugee camp in the occupied West Bank. Israel has acknowledged that Israeli fire probably killed Abu Akla, but denies allegations that the soldier intentionally targeted her. Abu Akla's family has submitted an official complaint to the International Criminal Court demanding justice for her killing. The Israeli military says it will seal off the occupied West Bank and the Gaza Strip ahead of the upcoming Jewish holidays. The regime says the Palestinians will not be allowed to leave the West Bank or Gaza to enter the occupied territories during the Jewish New Year and other festivities this month. The regime says during the closure, passage will only be allowed in humanitarian, medical, and exceptional cases. The closure comes against the backdrop of soaring tensions between Israelis and Palestinians over the past few months. The Israeli military has ramped up raids in the West Bank. Regime forces have killed dozens of Palestinians since March. And less than 2 weeks to Brazil's presidential elections, former President Lula da Silva is widening his lead against the incumbent Jair Bolsonaro. According to an opinion poll, the leftist former president now has a 10% lead over Bolsonaro. This indicates a 2-point increase from last week. Lula is back by 44% of the voters, while Bolsonaro maintains a 34% support. The survey expects a runoff in which Lula would win 50% of the ballots. President Bolsonaro has seen his popularity drop due to his controversial management of the coronavirus pandemic and the economy. He is planning to retire from practices if he fails to win the upcoming election.
Lula has returned to the southern region of Brazil, holding massive back-to-back campaign rallies with reinforced security. It was in this region that in 2018, Lula suffered an armed attack on his caravan, the same year he was imprisoned for 580 days in Curitiba. Workers' Party President Gleisi Hoffmann became emotional, reflecting back on the year when Lula was jailed in a move to bar his candidacy.
Esse é o seu retorno a Curitiba, Presidente Lula, no braço do povo.
This is your return to Curitiba, President Lula, in the arms of the people. It is redemption. It is the victory of our struggle over 580 days of injustice and over your persecution.
Polls show that the region continues to be a stronghold for Jair Bolsonaro. However, the incumbent faces fierce opposition, mainly as a result of what is perceived as Bolsonaro's failed policies.
O pior problema é que a fome voltou, né?
The worst problem is that hunger is back. You have more than 30 million people suffering from hunger. All the political and public advances that were made for the people are being taken away. People are not able to retire anymore. They want to starve people to death.
Our country needs to rebuild its democracy, rebuild its nation, its unity, and its political democracy by respecting its diverse institutions. With the current government, our country became a worldwide mockery, a joke worldwide. It became a country disregarded by the main international political alliances.
Now, with just 2 weeks remaining, the slogan out here is Lula in just one round. Camila Escalante in Curitiba.
Iran is commemorating its National Sacred Defense Week, which marks the beginning of the 1980s war between Iran and Iraq. The War University in Iran has hosted a ceremony to recount the humanitarian impacts of the war. Yusuf Jalali reports.
Free pigeons for a world free of war. Iran's War University hosted the director of the United Nations Information Center in Iran, Ingar Marie Veniz, along with military attachés from different embassies, to attend this ceremony dubbed the Book of Peace and Defense, which is themed with the 1980s Iran-Iraq War. The UNIC head read out a statement from United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres during the event.
Time to observe 24 hours of non-violence and ceasefire. We renew our call for all people to do more than lay down their weapons.
This event comes on the occasion of the National Sacred Defense Week, which marks the beginning of the 1980 to 1988 Iran-Iraq War, the longest armed conflict of the 20th century, which was waged by the then Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein and heavily funded by the West. Every year on the occasion, the Islamic Republic holds nationwide ceremonies to highlight its resistance against the Iraqi forces.
At that time, the Ba'athist regime, and on top of it, Saddam Hussein, was fully supported by numerous Western countries. The war continued for 8 years, but we fought the invaders and did not give an inch of our soil to them. So today, we as veterans feel bound to transfer our expertise and tactics to the new generation to preserve our defense might.
Saddam Hussein failed to make any achievement in his war against Iran, but the humanitarian effects of the offensive are still lingering in Iran, with many war veterans continuing to reel from exposure to chemical substances used by Iraqi forces. Those chemical materials were reportedly supplied by a number of German, French, and Dutch corporations.
The Islamic Republic takes great pride in how it defended the country during the Iraqi-imposed war, calling it the sacred defense and a drive for its present self-sufficiency in the military sector. Meanwhile, Tehran holds this annual commemoration ceremony as a chance to promote peace and shed light on the dark consequences of war. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The Russian president slams what he calls efforts by some countries to preserve their global dominance, saying such attempts are doomed to fail.
This objective development towards multipolarity unfortunately encounters the resistance of those who want to maintain the role of hegemon in world affairs and control everything, Latin America, Europe, Asia, and Africa. But it cannot go on like this forever. It's impossible. I'm even talking about this now outside the context of the events that are taking place in Ukraine.
Putin made the remarks while receiving the credentials of foreign ambassadors to Moscow. He also censured the U.S. and its Western allies for imposing, quote, illegitimate sanctions and putting pressure on other nations, including Russia, in order to consolidate their own positions. He said such actions will have a boomerang effect on those countries themselves. Putin added that Russia will not give up its sovereign right. He also noted that his country is pursuing a unifying interstate agenda. That, he said, is to help fight effective responses to numerous global challenges and threats and resolve acute regional conflicts. Putin said Russia will underline such stances at the 77th session of the UN General Assembly. Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov will address the summit on Saturday. Pro-Russians in several Ukrainian regions say they will hold referendums to join Russia in the coming days. The self-proclaimed Luhansk People's Republic passed a law on Tuesday outlining the details of the proposed vote. Russian media have cited sources as saying that the vote is set to take place between September 23rd and 27th. The self-proclaimed Donetsk People's Republic also plans a vote on the secession from Ukraine in the coming days. Authorities in the Russian-controlled southern Kherson region and the southeastern region also say they will hold similar referendums no later than September 27th. Moscow says it is up to the residents of those regions to decide if they want to be part of Russia.
From the very beginning of the special military operation, and before that, we've been saying that the peoples of the prospective territories should decide their own fate. The whole current situation confirms that they want to be master of their own fate.
The coordinated moves have sparked Kiev's angry reaction, with government pledging to, quote, eliminate Moscow's threat. The Ukrainian foreign minister says the proposed referendums will not change anything on the ground. The U.S., Germany, and NATO have called the planned votes a sham. NATO says the referendums are yet another escalation in the Ukraine war. France has called them a travesty. U.S. forces illegally stationed in Syria continue to plunder its natural resources, shipping out more oil from the country. Syrian media reports suggest that the American troops looted 60 oil tankers and smuggled them out of the Asaka province into U.S. bases in neighboring Iraq. Earlier this week, the U.S. troops sent a convoy of over 80 trucks, including tens of tankers, carrying stolen Syrian oil to Iraq via the illegal border crossing of Mahmoudiya and al-Walid. American forces are deployed in Syria without any authorization from Damascus or a U.N. mandate. Former President Donald Trump admitted on several occasions that American forces were in the country for its oil wealth. Damascus says that the U.S. and its allied militants have pillaged over 80% of Syria's daily crude production in the first half of 2022. That brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure. And provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
spread of modern-day slavery. In this special program, we examine the problem of modern-day slavery, which affects tens of millions of people worldwide. Despite the fact that traditional slavery was abolished towards the end of the 19th century, nonetheless, slavery exists today, albeit in a different form, and tens of millions of people are affected by it. Please stay with us for more. But what is modern-day slavery? Trafficking in persons, human trafficking, and modern slavery are used as umbrella terms to refer to both sex trafficking and compelled labor or forced labor. Modern slavery is the severe exploitation of other people for personal or commercial gain. Modern slavery is all around us, but often just out of sight. People can become entrapped making our clothes, serving our food, picking our crops, working in factories, working in houses as cooks or cleaners, etc. From the outside, it can look like a normal job, but people are being controlled. They can face violence or threats or be forced into inescapable debt. But what is the most common form of modern slavery today? The most common form of modern slavery is bonded labor or debt bondage. Debt bondage is a form of forced labor and happens when a person is forced to work to pay off a debt. They are tricked into working for little or no pay at all, with no control over their debt. This is thought to be the most widespread form of modern-day slavery today. Some people are forced to work in mines or farms and receive little or no pay. Statistics show that modern slavery is very prevalent in some countries, with large numbers of people effectively working as slaves. Generally speaking, in countries where there is a lack of legislation, or the legislation has many loopholes and is weak, or where there is widespread corruption, or countries where laws are simply not enforced, we see the problem of modern-day slavery. Generally, the poorer sections of the population, or those who are not protected by the laws of the land, fall prey to modern-day slavery. Iranian journalist and writer Mohammad Dowlati defines modern slavery as, if a person is forced to work for little or no pay, possibly under very difficult circumstances, and other people benefit from this forced labor, and there is no way that person can escape from this predicament, then that person is a modern-day slave. Another aspect of modern slavery, which is not common knowledge, is that this phenomena has spread to many industrialized and developed countries, as well as developing nations and underdeveloped countries. For example, in Britain, an industrialized nation, there are at least 10,000 individuals who are classified as modern-day slaves. In fact, in virtually all Western nations who claim to champion human rights today, we see the problem of modern slavery in all of its different shapes and forms. One notable example is immigrant workers, mostly from Latin America, who work as seasonal labor in American farms, and in particular in the state of California. These immigrant workers are exploited heavily, receiving very little money for their work, and are often threatened with deportation from the United States. Another notable example is the trafficking of Eastern European women and girls to various countries in Western Europe, working as prostitutes and sex slaves. Sex trafficking from Eastern to Western Europe may also occur through a specific form of coercion, whereby individuals are compelled to continue in prostitution through the use of unlawful debt, purportedly incurred through their transportation, recruitment, or even their sale, which exploiters insist they must pay off before they can be set free. Another form of modern-day slavery is sex trafficking. Forced prostitution is another form of modern-day slavery, which we see most often in Western nations, particularly in Western Europe, North America, Eastern Europe, and Southeast Asia. The latest United Nations report called Global Estimates of Modern Slavery, published by the International Labour Organization, ILO, International Organization for Migration, IOM, and International Human Rights Group, Walk Free, revealed last year some 50 million people were living in modern slavery, 28 million of them in forced labor, and 22 million in forced marriages. According to the International Labor Organization's Director General, Guy Ryder, "It is shocking that the situation of modern slavery is not improving. Nothing can justify the persistence of this fundamental abuse of human rights." Compared to 2016 global estimates, 10 million more people were in modern slavery in 2021, with women and children disproportionately vulnerable. According to the United Nations report, modern slavery occurs in almost every country in the world and cuts across ethnic, cultural, and religious lines. And, of course, in industrialized and developed nations, we see this phenomena very clearly. More than half of all forced labor and quarter of all forced marriages can be found in upper middle income or high income countries. 86% of forced labor cases are found in the private sector, with forced commercial sexual exploitation representing 23%, almost 4 out of 5 victims of whom are females. Forced labor is another form of modern-day slavery. Forced labor, sometimes also referred to as labor trafficking, is when a person uses force or physical threats, psychological coercion, abuse of the legal process, deception, or other coercive means to compel someone else to work. Once a person's labor is exploited by such means, the person's prior consent to work for an employer is legally irrelevant. The employer is a trafficker, and the employee is a trafficking victim. Migrants around the world are particularly vulnerable to this form of human trafficking. But individuals also may be forced into labor in their own countries. Female victims of forced or bonded labor, especially women and girls in domestic servitude, are often sexually abused or exploited as well. Another unsavory aspect of modern-day slavery is forced child labor. Although children may legally engage in certain forms of work, children can also be found in slavery or slavery-like situations. Some indicators of forced labor of a child include situations in which the child appears to be in the custody of a non-family member who requires the child to perform work that financially benefits someone outside of the child's family and does not offer the child the option of leaving the work, such as forced begging. Yet another aspect of modern-day slavery is unlawful recruitment and use of child soldiers in wars around the world. Child soldiering is a manifestation of human trafficking when it involves the unlawful recruitment or use of children through the use of force, fraud or coercion by armed forces as combatants or other forms of labour. Perpetrators may be government armed forces, paramilitary organisations or rebel groups around the world. Many children are forcibly abducted to be used as combatants in all sorts of wars and conflicts around the world.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Persian language in India.
Part 1.
India is a nation with a history and culture that goes back 3,000 years before the birth of Christ. It's a strange land in Southeast Asia where 1.2 billion people live and practice numerous religions. India's 3,200,000 square kilometers shares its borders with Pakistan, Bangladesh, Nepal, China, and Burma. India abounds with natural beauties from the Himalayan plateau, the Ganges and mountainous regions, to plains, forests and deserts with various weather conditions. The national flag of India is a horizontal rectangular tricolour of deep saffron, white and Indian green, with the Ashok Chakra, a 24-spoke wheel in navy blue at its centre. India Gate, Qutb Minar, Humayun Tomb and Taj Mahal can all be found in the city of Agra, 70 kilometers from Delhi, Indian culture is brimming with elements of Iranian culture and civilization. Every inch of India's vast expanse bears witness to that. In the buildings and structures, in the manuscripts and libraries, and even the streets. For about 800 years, Farsi or Persian was the language used by Indian royals and people in administrative positions.
I'm Hassan Zaidi. I was born in Iran, but my mother and father are Indians who immigrated to Iran. At the moment, I'm a student at university. I study social communication science. For my thesis, I decided to seize the opportunity to do some research about history, civilizations, architecture, and the Persian language. What comes to our aid in our research is not just the literature we find in libraries, but the general atmosphere of the streets, the people's traditions and culture, historical buildings left to us from past generations, and the art forms that this ancient land has to offer in every street and alleyway. It seems the Persian language is what the people of India and Iran have in common. It's what brings them together. The last 800 years show that the Persian language's influence over India has affected many elements of everyday life for its people, giving it a Persian hue.
History tells us that Farsi came to India around 800 years ago, especially to its northern regions, influencing the social dynamics of India as well as its politics, economy, and culture, particularly in the earlier of those 8 centuries. Its effect was so profound that from then on, most of the country's cultural, religious, political, literary, and administrative texts were written in Persian, as were all personal and government documents, including judicial decrees and the like. For centuries, this land fostered and cultivated the Persian language.
We have a very famous quatrain from the famous Iranian poet Moslehuddin Saadi Shirazi. He says, all mankind are actually part of one body. And if one part aches, the other part also gets affected. And we have got the famous hadith, according to Islamic sources also, from Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. He says, kullana min Adam wa Adam min turab. He says, all of us are from Adam, and Adam is from clay. That means all mankind have got a single root. And if you look into history, this is all the Iranians and the Indians, they're actually very close to each other. Some thousands of years back, maybe some 3,000 years back or more than that, there were migrations, waves of migration from Central Asia of the Aryan race. One branch came and settled in the Iranian plateau, and the other branch came to North India. And they had the same tendencies, they had the same culture, they had the same actual religion and ideology and the same ethnicity. And in course of time, because of the geographical factors, there might have been some separation between them. And there was an independent evolution, those living in the Iranian plateau and those living in North Indian plain. But actually, since the roots of the people, of the race were same, there has so many similarities and commonalities.
History has several explanations as to how the Persian language found its way into cultures so far afield. One is the immigration of Iranians to other lands, some of them caused by war and upheaval. Thus it was that Farsi became the language of science, wealth, religion, and power in India. It was during the time of the Indian King Humayun and the Safavid period in Iran that many people emigrated from Iran. Humayun, who ascended to the throne with the help of Iran's Safavid king Tahmaseb, welcomed Iranian scholars, poets, and scientists to India. Among the poets that went to India, some of them ending up in the royal court, were Zahiri Naishaburi, Ghazali Mashhadi, Talib Amoli, Kalim Kashani, and Halim Lahiji. The emigration of Iranian traders, cultural figures, and scientists to India was the most influential element in the spread of Farsi in that country.
India has been a center of Persian studies since the last, say, 700-800 years. And you see, initially it was mystic literature which was brought to India, and that created really a great impact on Indian psychology, where, you know, the poets, the authors, philosophers, all of them, in fact, combined together, got together, putting heads together, and he started writing on Indo-Persian ethos. And therefore, you see, a large number of mystics we find in India, in every nook and corner of India, and they really created a very good atmosphere of learning Persian language and literature.
Kings fond of the Persian language were in power in India. Their support for Iranian scientists and poets helped the language take root in that country, where it soon would become one of the nation's official languages.
There has been quite a lot of influence from Iran to India. There is up to 1850s, quite last century, Persian was a court language in India. So if you see archives or documents which are in Persian language. So till the kings and whoever came, they had an Iranian lineage, they came from Iran.
The effects of the Persian language on Indian culture are very apparent. This can be seen clearly in the country's language, literature, architecture, and art forms. There are few cultural or scientific institutes in India that do not display signs of Persian influence in poetry and verse alike. In universities and colleges across India, there are more than 50 Persian language departments hard at work, and more than 100 schools teach Farsi as part of their curriculum. In most traditional and Islamic schools, students study Farsi texts and are familiarized with the works of the great Iranian poets like Sa'di, Hafiz, Ferdowsi, and Khayyam.
Some of the Iranian poets have been very popular amongst the Iranians, see. Take, for example, Omar Khayyam. Omar Khayyam has been very popular in India, and we have so many Indian Omar Khayyam as a result of the popularity of Omar Khayyam in India. And what we see that a great scholar and poet of Hindi literature, Harivansh Rai Bachchan, who wrote Madhubala, Madhushala, and Madhukalas, you see, they are all, people say, that is a second version of Khayyam's Rubaiyat. Now, apart from Khayyam, Nizami Ganjavi is also very famous, in fact, like, you know, Khamsa Nizami, and Amir Khusro writing another Khamsa. So therefore, Maulana Jalaluddin Rumi, Hafiz, and Sa'di, and Jami, you see, later on, you see, all of them have created their own methods and their own place amongst the hearts and minds of the people of India. For instance, you see, if you go to the southern part of India, you will find a number of Omar Khayyams in Tamil, Telugu, Malayalam languages. Why? Because, you know, the kind of poetry Omar Khayyam rendered in Persian.
Mm-hmm. But the manuscripts written in Persian that can be found in libraries across the country bear witness to the spread of Farsi across this great nation down the centuries. There are very few buildings that have not been embellished with Persian calligraphy, and very few libraries that do not hold Persian manuscripts. The head of the Persian Language Research Center in New Delhi supports that claim.
A stroll along India's streets and a quick glance at some of its buildings show just how much the Persian language meant to its people, and still does today. Silent slabs of stone and placards tell the tale of Farsi's spread across India. The Taj Mahal, that belongs to the 16th century, has many a Persian inscription. Farsi has been used to inscribe the graves of those who inspired and built the Taj Mahal, portraying the marriage of the two cultures most elegantly. But apart from the Taj Mahal, there is the Humayun tomb, another masterpiece left behind by an Indian royal. The affection Indian royals have for the Persian language is apparent here also. By using Farsi in their architecture, we see how the language was inscribed on their hearts as well.
Major was the architecture, in fact, you see. The Iranian architecture is seen everywhere, you see, with the combination of Indian architecture, you see. Like Taj Mahal. Taj Mahal, you see, you cannot really think about any architecture by ignoring Taj Mahal, in fact. And similarly, you see, all the forts, you see, which we find in India, they are testimony to the Iranian architecture. Similarly, you see, the paintings and the calligraphy particularly, you see, if you see the type of calligraphy developed by the Iranians in India with the help of the Indians, you see, and the interaction between the Muslim world and the Hindu world, in fact, you see, so they really, it's a wonderful combination. You see.
Persian dictionaries written in India have helped the proliferation of the Persian language. This in itself shows how dear the Persian language became in that country, and how towards the end of the 15th century, the Indian people cherished Persian words and phrases maybe more than Iranians themselves. 12 Persian dictionaries were compiled in India from the 15th to the 17th century, and the archives of Indian universities and literary institutes are full of Persian texts. Thus it was that with the spread of the Persian language, the Persian or Iranian culture crept into the lives of the Indian people. The bond became so strong that it went beyond the physical aspects of life to the metaphysical. Besides affecting India's economy, political and social makeup and culture, it influenced the people's faith as well. These changes can be seen from the moment Farsi entered the culture to this day. It was with the help of Farsi that Islam managed to enter India and come to be known as a liberating faith alongside others.
There is definitely a connection because Islam came to India through channels. One of the most important and all-pervading channels has been the Persian channel. That is the people, the civilization, which was created there with Iran as its center and whole Central Asia part of that very civilization. Iran, when I talk of Iran in Persian, this is not the present geographical Iran. This is the Iran of Central Asia because Central Asia was part of that Persian civilization. And Islam came to India largely through the channels which were created by the Persian Islamized civilization. So we had the people the scholars, the saints, the scientists, all of them, they used Persian as a language of intellectual discourse as well as a language of the academic language. And there were Muslims ruling India for almost 800 years, and court language was Persian. Then again, Islam's main sources, primarily in Arabic. Then after Arabic, the most important work which was done in any other language is Persian, whether it is in Tafsirul Quran, whether it is the Sharah of Ahadith, whether it is Tasawwuf, whether it is Ilmul Kalam, or whether it is philosophy, and also even scientific works. We have scholars like Al-Biruni, who wrote in both, in Arabic language as well as in Persian language.
When I think about the connection between Farsi and India's history, I'm convinced that in order to understand that history, we must travel down the path of language, the Persian language. The language manuscripts and ancient texts are written in, the language poetry was versed in. Farsi, which embellishes ancient structures and was the means of communication between governments and the people down the ages, the language traders used to communicate in strange lands, the green treasure of India.
In the limelight.
In continuation of its wrong policies, the Biden administration increased the sale of arms to Taiwan with all its might, causing China's anger and concern. Taiwan is under the sovereignty of China, and America has recognized this issue, but the American government continues to interfere in China's internal affairs. And by illegally selling weapons to Taiwan, it is trying to separate it from mainland China. Analysts say the US is trying to implement the Ukrainian model in Taiwan and start a war in this region. Also, China charged the United States with violating its commitment to the One China principle and interfering in China's internal affairs. We have taken a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. First of all, we look at SputnikNews.com's website coverage of this issue. The U.S. has funneled tens of billions of dollars in weapons to Chinese Taipei since 1949 to purportedly help it maintain its autonomy from Beijing, even after officially acknowledging the island is part of China and severing formal relations with Taipei in 1979. As U.S. President Joe Biden recently presses Congress to approve another $1.1 billion in weapons and military support for Chinese Taipei, experts from Chinese Taipei and mainland China agreed that no amount of American pledges or aid can make Chinese Taipei secure. Only cross-strait peace can do that. Thus far, in his administration, Joe Biden has sold $1.06 billion in weapons to the island, meaning the proposed deal would more than double the military aid that Joe Biden has given Chinese Taipei. The move comes weeks after House Speaker Nancy Pelosi visited Chinese Taipei and met with senior leaders on the island, despite warnings by Beijing and the Pentagon alike that it would be provocative to do so. Several other U.S. lawmakers have followed suit, and the People's Liberation Army, the PLA, held massive war exercises and drills all around the island in response. Professor Wang Yi Wei, director of the Institute on International Affairs at Beijing's Renmin University in China, told Sputnik News, "Actually, the United States should be